Hi, and welcome to another episode of Django Chats. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hi. This week, I don't know what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about some talk I gave at DjangoCon Europe a couple of years ago.
Yes. So last year, so this is the talk that I first became acquainted with who you are, though most people haven't watched the talk, which is outrageous. We'll link to it. But it was a talk on growing old gracefully and as a career programmer, which really resonated with me in my 30s when I saw it. And we wanted to sort of talk about some of the themes in there, because I think they'll resonate with a lot of people, regardless of where you are in your career. Because stereotypically, programming is a young person's career. You come out of school, you can jump right into potentially a high-paying job, you get a lot of authority. But you will find that as you continue, experience is not always appreciated, and there is quite a bit of ageism. And so I thought you had a lot of good perspective on that, that we could kind of dive into some of the themes.
Yeah,
in this podcast.
So I'd been like, so when I gave that talk, I'd been programming, I don't know, a decade, say, and like professional freelance, you know, I'd done the London agency thing, I'd done this, I'd done that. And what would I say? What was the issue? It was like, yeah.
I mean, it's almost a defense of programming, I would say, on the one hand. You're sort of saying it's saying gracefully, right? It's not, you're not put out to pasture when you hit 35.
Yeah, but exactly. Yeah. There was this. So one of the hooks was like this headline that I saw on Hacker News that programmers, by the time you're 40, get a plan B, because it's like you can't carry on programming because you can't get hired for a start. Why? Because you're expensive, because you're experienced, because you've got a family. You need more money than some junior developers fresh out of school. But the hiring manager, well, they don't know you. They don't know what. All they've got is your CV. Like, so how are they gonna justify that sometimes quite a big multiple of remuneration? And so it can be increasingly hard to get hired. But also if you're in a job, like, so, you know, I gave an example, IBM constructively dismissing all the old hands. So they've got these consultants that go around and help design systems in IBM's client companies. You know, this is the tech consulting that they do. And they would be sending these people who had families to far remote offices and all the rest, doing everything they could to get rid of them. And in the end, they were, you know, prosecuted for constructive dismissal.
Yeah. I mean, it's always a slap on the wrist, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't put off the behavior, but the point is that, you know, it was like there's this picture that programming is something that you do for 10 years and then get out of. But I'm like, no. Like, programming is, you know, it's like my lifeblood. It's something that deeply stimulates me and that I want to carry on doing forever.
Right. But I think it's, and this is, you know, you talk about what does that path look like? Because I recall being in San Francisco at a startup in my 20s and sort of going, I don't see any 30-something programmers. Now, again, I was like in the heart of startup land, but I remember thinking, where do they go?
Right.
And because I think that the paths diverge, right? I mean, so I'll give you the stereotypes, then you can disabuse them. I mean, so the stereotypes would be, you know, if you're a man, you grow a neck beard and you go work for some huge company in the peninsula, and you're an individual contributor. So you're pegged as an individual contributor, which is a little bit of a, ooh, they don't work well with others, and you better be really good, and you could be fired quickly, but you have a niche that you become an expert in. Or you become a manager, and then you're losing your technical skills, but, you know, you're in charge of stuff, you have to do hiring. But I wasn't aware back then, I'm still always a little bit surprised of what is that happy path from your 20s to your 30s to your 40s, because there is this stigma that you can't just be a developer. That's a waste of skills. And unless, especially if you're in a larger organization, there's only a tiny number of spots for you to be an architect or whatever title they call it. You know, they do, you know, the turnover, even at Facebook, Google, these companies, the average age is something like 27.
Yeah.
It's very young. A lot of people go and do two, three years and then they go where, right? And that's sort of the question.
Okay, so, right. So there's this image of, I don't know if you, I sort of got these images, maybe a Charlton Heston films back from the day, like being a slave on a Roman galleon, right? And beating the drums and whipping them if they stop, you know, and till they literally fall over at their oars, and then they get them out from the chains, throw them into the sea and chain the next slave onto the thing. And it's like, that's the startup thing, right? You get these youngsters in who are all keen, and you flog them till they fall over, and then you get a new one.
Stereotypically, yes.
Right? That's well, okay.
Yes.
But there are companies which aren't like that, right? Yeah. So my first sort of thing is, hey, look outside of tech, because in the, do you know what, in the real world, you know, these ideas that software is eating the world, well, it really is. And if you can, if you've got Django type skills, if you can code up a block and then you can take those to a real company, you can do stuff in that will just be massively productivity boosting. So you're in a department of you're in a normal office, a clerical department, doing something in some company that makes, you know, actual physical widgets in the real world. If you can write some software that will just smooth a process or whatever as part of your real world job, you're adding massive value. And that's software that probably can't get written by an outside consultant because it's you have too domain expertise.
Well, too expensive, and they don't have the domain expertise to do it. So that is one thing. Is it's, I mean, especially in San Francisco, there's a feeling like if you didn't spend your weekend, you know, writing a compiler in C, you're slacking off. And then the real world, people can't use PowerPoint.
Yeah, you know? And people people can't use Python, for instance, at all.
They can't even install it. By the way, installpython3.com. I finally have that live with if you want to. A working, opinionated way to just get it working. Go check that out. I finally have that up.
Super. Well done.
But yeah, like, but exactly. This is the thing.
Outside of the tech bubble, it's not this. There are companies that will, millions of companies that will be desperate for your technical expertise because we're kind of like at the cusp. The image I gave was off the base of one of the keynotes there on the Industrial Revolution, was that we're in a kind of a second Industrial Revolution now. We're at the point where if you've imagined in a Dickens novel where people are paying scribes to read and write for them because they can't read and write themselves. Well, that's kind of like where we're at with programming, is that it's just literacy now. In 50 years' time, like all my kids already, they're already learning Python at school. They're just, you know, coding away and, you know, scripting things up. And they just,
Well, they're not in the US then, right, if they're learning it at school.
Okay, but maybe it's another 10 years, maybe it's another 20 years.
Yeah,
but
it's coming.
And basic scripting skills will be, you know, there will always be professional programmers writing compilers and all the rest of it, as there are always, there are still professional writers. But that basic kind of, I can script up something to automate a boring bit of my, you know, the automate the boring parts bit of the Python book, right? That sort of stuff, if you can take that into the real world, you are phenomenally valuable these days. You can do that, and you can code and you can program and you can do it in a world where you're not, you know, spending all your creative passion and energy on finding ever more creative ways to get people to click on a link.
Well, right. And that's the thing is it is hard to break into tech. And, you know, especially when you're new, you just accept and want to jump through whatever hoops are thrown your way. But there are bad companies. There are abusive bosses.
I think it's hard
when you feel trapped, but there is a bigger world. And as you said, I think looking beyond just straight tech is a good idea at any stage of your career.
But also as well, you find you like, there's a kind of market value thing. Like young programmers, they don't realize what they should be asking for their salary. And so they sort of take a much lower salary than they're really worth. Whereas in the real world, you can get out there and you can negotiate a much better remuneration. And actually, do you know what? You've got paid vacation and you've got holiday, you know, healthcare, and you've got, you know, a pension fund,
right,
and you've got job security, and they've got a career path for you where they're actually trying to invest in you because you're a valuable asset. And that is so far removed from the tech startup world that...
Well, I would say... as some advice to my younger self, if you want to know what a company's going to be like, look at the top person or persons and see what their background is. Is it in tech? If it's not in tech, they're always going to undervalue tech. That's just how it is. It's either tech or sales. And see what their life is like. I mean, I made a vow to myself after coming out of startups that I wouldn't work for another startup unless there was at least a parent who was an executive, who was a high-level person. Because as a parent myself, it's just no way that a non-parent is going to understand. And, you know, you could say that limits my scope, but also I have an awareness that, you know, if I wasn't a parent, I wouldn't get it. But if someone, you know, so look to people in power and see what behaviors they are modeling, because whatever the company says, it all trickles down from the top people.
Yeah, like
so look there.
Unlimited leave, but you're not really allowed to take any, and you know all these other.
I mean, I think that's
things like a free lunch, like you know they do a free lunch, but that's kind of dangerous. Like, why is it that they're trapping you in with your workmates? Why aren't you allowed to take that hour's lunch break and go off and do something different and get a change of energy and you know recuperate your mental space before you come? No, you have to be hothoused in the canteen together. Like, now that's not always evil, but hang on a sec. Well, these after work drinks that we have to go to, like, hang on, after work, shouldn't I be going home and spending time with my family? Why am I still right here?
I mean, I would say a great company, I mean, this is what I tried to do when I was managing a team, is sit people down and say, here's the path we see for you. So, you know, this is what success 1, 2, 5 years out looks like, and be clear about it. I wouldn't expect a company to do that for you. You have to have that in your head, because ultimately no one cares about you as much as you care about yourself. But you should have a plan for, and sort of say, well, this is what I want to get. And then know that, unfortunately, in a lot of companies, basically the only time you can negotiate properly is when you're hired. Yeah. And once you're in the queue, you're just on whatever, you know, 2% a year, whatever it is. And that's just how it is. And, you know, your manager, I was a manager, they don't have the power to control this. They are given a budget, and they're a bit confined by the realities of the system. So it depends on the place. But when I was a manager, I always told employees, tell me when you get a better offer, because I may not know if what we're paying isn't market rate. I want the chance to match it. But what often happens is that junior developers or developers, they're in a place a year or two, starts being less new. They hear that a friend's somewhere else getting paid more money. They kind of grouse about it to their manager. The manager is like, well, what do you want me to do about it? I've got my budget. And then they start interviewing, they get an offer, and it's, you know, 30% more, 20% more. And then they just kind of drop the bomb, and the manager saying, oh, I'm going. When, if they'd had the conversation with the manager, you know, the manager wants to know, generally speaking. I wanted to know. It doesn't mean I can match it, but I want the chance to match it. Because if you just drop a bomb and leave, that's not always the best way to do it.
Yeah, but
that's a lot of times how, especially, you know, someone newer in their career, they feel kind of bad about having other offers. I mean, I always told employees, you should know what the market is, and you should tell me what it is. You know, don't feel bad about talking to competitors. I want people who are wanted by other companies, and I want them to be here for the right reasons, not someone who feels trapped.
Yeah, and this is particularly difficult in startups, because they're normally burning through capital, and they've got a budget, and it's plotted out over the months, and they can't just sort of double the programming budget, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
because that doesn't fit in. So they'll let go of the person with all the knowledge and the year and a half of experience, and they'll hire a new junior in, and they'll, you know, and this horrible startup thing. But I think real companies, like established companies who've got an actual revenue stream and are profitable, they have much more flexibility in, you know, giving realistic raises.
I think so, yeah. And I think it's hard being the in charge of a startup where you're sitting there going, how am I going to pay the bills this month? How I need to raise a round, and at the same time rally the troops and be like, yep, everything's fine. You know, you don't want to lie to them, but you also don't want to burden them with the anxieties that you feel as a small business owner or a startup owner.
No,
so
I
have quite a lot of empathy for the position, but you know, be aware that startups are high risk by design. But you know, but we sort of slagged on startups. I would say startups can be great for your career, because you'll have a chance to spread your wings. You'll take on responsibility. You can manage people within a year or two. They can be really great, but there's a risk involved there.
Yeah,
so,
and you've got to go into them open-minded. And like the big danger is burnout here. The big danger is that they do, you're tied to that oar, and they don't care about you, and they don't look after you, and they're only expecting you to be there a year, 18 months. And so you've got to look after yourself at that point, and you've got to be careful, and you've got to say, look, I set these limits for myself, and I won't be Stockholm syndromed into, you know, working the late nights or the weekends or all those things that just aren't conducive to a healthy life.
Well, and that's why I said, look at the behavior at the top. You know, I think, you know, look at like Elon Musk, who allegedly works 100 hours a week. You know, how's he doing? Mixed bag. He'd probably be doing better if he worked less.
Yeah, maybe. I don't follow the news.
Who knows? But again, I think part of it, though, is, you know, with experience, you sort of realize things you can change and things you can't change. So companies often kind of are how they are, and you may not be able to have this kind of frank conversation with your manager, in which case, leave. I mean, tech right now is, there's a lot of jobs out there, and you are not trapped. And it is easy to get this Stockholm Syndrome approach, especially because you spend all this time with folks and, you know, it's fun to do, but you do have to look out for yourself, as you point out. And I, you know, in your talk, you know, the thing is, you want to look out for yourself without being like crabby and just saying no to your colleagues all the time.
No, right. No, but it's self-care.
So it's how
self-care is the number one priority. So it's a marathon, not a sprint. We're working on the assumption that you're going to do this career indefinitely, that you want to be a career programmer because programming fulfills you and it's a deeply rewarding activity and it's well remunerated and it's secure in terms of there being massive market demand for it. So you're going to keep going for it. So you can't work in a way that means in 6 months time or 12 months time or 18 months time, you're going to hit the floor and need, you know, 9 months in rehab. That's like, you just can't work that hard. It's not sustainable. So self-care is your number one priority. So, okay, well, having said that, how then do you build a career? And how then do you find the companies that aren't, because if you just, you know, type in tech job, the only thing you're going to find is, you know, these kind of startups or digital agencies, which they all kind of have the same model. They're all rapidly hiring. They're all desperate. So how do you find companies that are not like that? Well, I say in the talk, be prolific, you know, I give the example of contributing to open source, but you know, do that. If you've got an hour a week, do an hour a week, but that adds up. If you've been doing that for for 6 months, oh, hang on, that person's been active and they've got something to show for it. If you've been doing it for 3 years, wow, it's actually quite impressive. And it wasn't that you killed yourself to do that. You just gave a little bit of time. Give that time, limit it. Be prolific, be diligent, get on with it. Don't be on Facebook, don't be on Twitter, don't be on Slack all the time. Just get on and do your work so that when you're not working, you can relax because, you know, you take the time. When you are relaxing, don't be on Facebook, don't be on Twitter, be on Slack because you're relaxing. And then the secret is to be social. Get out and put yourself out there. Don't just be the ghost who codes. Don't just sit there behind the keyboard going, oh, you know, I've done my thing and then I never say anything else. Because if you can reach out, the opportunities will appear.
It's true that it's all about your networking connections. And even though we're staring at a computer, the best jobs, the best opportunities come from knowing people, from going to a meetup, from being involved in a conference, from volunteering for something. And as you say, too, programmers need to think about their brand. You need to think about, it's worth having a blog. It's worth having contributions to open source you could point to. Because generally, you can't talk about or show the code that you worked on at work.
Yeah.
It's proprietary. So even if you come out of some amazing place, I would want to see some of your code. And if I'm hiring you, if you have no code to speak of, you know, and again, especially as you get older, you don't have to be coding after work. You don't have to have infinite side projects, but you should have something public facing. You should have something available because, again, even if you come out of, the best Django place in the world, I would want to see some real code before I hired you. And I would rather, you know, see code and have a conversation about that code rather than give you some whiteboard or give you some project to do that will blow up time. I would much rather talk about, well, tell me about this contribution you made to Django, small as it may be. Yeah. Tell me about that talk you gave. Tell me about this blog post. You know, that's a much better conversation. But you're going to have that conversation. You're going to have to prove it. And as you said, you can't just be head down getting attaboys from your colleagues. I mean, nobody knows what you're doing.
Yeah, no, exactly. And so can you, you know, if you're at a company, can you open source something? Maybe not. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. You can't, but if you can, that will count. Can you get your company to give you an amount of time to say work on Django or work on Django REST framework or work on, you know, to contribute? And then if you can get that time, then that gives you an opportunity to then build something to point at and say, look, hey, I did this. I did that.
You know, also what you said about burnout and, you know, stepping away from the computer. I mean, this is something we all struggle with. I still struggle with. I think especially, I mean, personally, I struggle with this in the context of having a busy personal life with a lot of responsibilities. Sometimes distractions feel nice, right? It's a little bit of an escapism. And yet, you know, if I come in on a Monday and I'm not feeling great, it's probably because I spent an hour or two doing this or that. I really didn't let myself disconnect from technology. And then, you know, I come in with these feelings of burnout, of it doesn't matter, it's meaningless, you know, what's the point?
Okay, but let's take Facebook or Twitter or whatever, like one of these things where they're on your mobile phone. And yeah, 5 minutes, fine, it's no problem. 10 minutes, no, fine. But then it gets to that point where you put your phone down and you're sat there and then you pick it up again. And then you look at it again. And then you think, oh, I've looked at it, it's really dull. And I've scrolled past the same 50 updates 50 times. You put it down. And then all of a sudden it's back in your hand and you're looking at it again. And this is on Saturday evening when you're meant to be, you know, relaxing and spending time with your wife or your partner or whoever it is. And it's like, what are you doing? And it's not your fault. It's like your brain is hardwired. There's this
Monkey brain is, yeah.
But it's rat brain, actually. It's
It's rat brain. Okay.
Yeah. It's like it's this positive reinforcement cycle where there's this really tiny dopamine hit from the information that you take in, and it's like, because it's variable, because you never know when the new update will come. Mm-hmm. There's this kind of, if it was, so they did this experiment. They got rats in a cage, right? And if they give them a button where it gives out food and it reliably gives out food, the rat will press the button when it's hungry, it'll eat the food and it will go away and do its thing, and it'll come back when it wants some more and press the button again. It's all, you know, quite healthy. But if the button is random, where the rat never knows whether it will give food if they press it, the rat will sit there and it will just end up pressing the button all the time, and it will get really fat and overweight. And it's because there's this kind of variable reinforcement. And that's exactly what it's like with email, exactly what it's like with social media. And it's an addiction, and it's nothing that you've done wrong. It's your brain. It's the way your mammalian brain is wired to keep you alive in a situation of scarcity. But what's that doing? Is it's destroying your ability to rest and your ability to concentrate and your ability to be peaceful in your mind when you're not at work, and even when you're at work, right?
Sometimes analogies to other things are helpful here. I mean, if anyone's been an athlete or focused on, you know, any discipline, a lot of times it's the rest part that is the challenging part, but the most important part, because it is hard to rest. It is hard to disconnect. It is hard to have that space, and yet you have to have that to recover, to let your subconscious work, to have things, you know, pull in. And, you know, especially a lot of programmers, I think we're sort of, you know, knowledge addicts. We just want more, 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 more.
Yeah.
There's always more to learn. There's always more news. There's more programming things. You know, I mean, I have a bookshelf of programming books. I certainly sometimes on a weekend will sit there and think, yeah, I should dip into, you know, that algorithms book. And it's fine sometimes, but it just means I can never disconnect. So it's, as you said, the awareness that that's how we're wired.
But I think if the algorithms book is an order of magnitude better than the mobile phone.
Right.
In that at least then you're sat down and concentrating on something and getting into it. It's not like this cookie of content, cookie of information. You're snacking. It's this sort of intellectual snacking, which is exhausting. Anyway, I talk about this lots in the talk, right? And I talk about some software that I use to block distractions. I delete everything from my mobile phone so I can't get on that. There are various techniques.
And what do you think about career path, right? I mean, so you're not a manager. I'm not a manager right now. What's your take on that tension? Because it is a little bit the Peter principle. If you're a great programmer, you're very much pulled toward managing. And there is definitely is a stigma towards, you know, individual contributors of a certain age.
Yeah, okay. So I deliberately avoided corporate structure. I like being freelance. I like working remotely. I like, you know, it doesn't mean I don't work in a team, but I don't want to be in an office environment. I don't want that. But I, you know, as I get older now, I think, oh, you know, if I could establish something that I might take on some youngsters, and I might build a team, but I'd keep it a small team, and it would be very much a craft-based team. It would be like about building software. I don't want to be in a kind of office environment where it's so big that it ceases to be a workshop, a software workshop, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, if you see these diagrams of after like five or six people on a team, you look at the web of connections, it just becomes like exponential.
Yeah.
And that is kind of why, a three-person team can move faster than a 10-person team. And that's kind of where good managers come in, because it is hard to organize large teams, and you do need them for some projects, but it's a big jump from, two or three folks to a full team.
I think, Fred Brooks, the Mythical Man Month, he's got a team structure, which is like a programming team should be structured a bit like a surgical team. So you've got an experienced surgeon with perhaps an assistant who is sort of what you call a senior, and then perhaps a couple of juniors with them, but also then someone on the side who's doing tooling and, you know, that works like the auxiliary in a operating theatre who's doing other bits and bobs. I can't remember the exact structure that he outlines there, but it's a way of trying to structure a software team maintaining that expertise. And when you're talking about someone who's got 15, 20 years of programming experience, to move them sideways into management is to really lose an opportunity to create something powerful.
Yeah, I think that book, he also has the phrase, what one engineer can do in 1 month, two can do in 2 months.
Right. Yeah, because you've got that communication problem. But this idea of how you structure a team is about solving that communication problem.
Well, and that's why places like Basecamp famously only have three-person teams for any new project. I mean, they're not standard, but I think can learn a lot from how they do things, where they have two developers and one designer for any new project, and they work in 6 week increments. So they kind of, they don't, you know, spend 6 months or a year on something without revising. Can we just toss it?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's important, because it's this idea that they have of a bet. You place a bet, and one thing that, you know, it's a curse of software is software estimation, because you want to plan this giant, you know, space shuttle, the navigation system size piece of software. You can't plan that up front. And so their way of getting around that is to do 6 week bets. And the worst they've lost is 6 weeks.
Right. And there is that, you know, the sunk cost fallacy. Certainly no one likes to throw out old code. But I think, you know, so what's the appeal of being a manager? I mean, I've been a manager. I mean, I totally get it in terms of, I think if you have had bad managers or great managers, you sit there and go, well, what's really holding back the team? If you have a good team, a lot of times it's the management. It's the goal setting. And it also is a new challenge, which if you're 5-10 years into your career, you know, sometimes do you want to just sling straight code? You know, maybe not. So I think the difference is when you want that challenge versus you're forced into that challenge. So it's a hard thing in tech. I mean, there are people who say you should, you know, bounce back and forth every 2 years, you know, coding, managing. I think, you know, in a large organization, there's much more of a managerial class, and that sort of makes sense. That probably has to be. But in smaller companies, yeah, I don't know. It's a tension. I'm not sure of the answer. I mean, basically, you know, there is a nice career path as a programmer in your 20s, and then it's a little bit like choose your own adventure. It's not like careers where it's just mapped out for you.
As you get older, you have to be, if you want to stay at the keyboard, if you want to keep developing, you have to be very deliberate about making sure that you remain competitive. You know, you've got to imagine yourself going to a company where you've got a hiring manager who's trying to recruit in tech, and you're up against some 20-year-old, and they have to be able to see the value in you. You have to be able to demonstrate that. Otherwise, they can't hire you.
Right. And so pointing to open source contributions, talking about things you've worked on. I guess with concluding thoughts, a lot of it is you can't make someone see something they don't see. If they don't value experience programmers, they just don't.
You can't sell experienced programmers to the kind of for want of a better word, sweatshop environment that a lot of tech companies are. So you've got to look at that company, and are they even in the market for something which isn't the junior developer who's going to work the long hours and, you know, burn themselves out, and then they'll get a new one.
Some of the very best programmers I know probably almost exclusively work a pretty limited number of work hours. Take that for what it is. But they found a way to have the discipline to, you know, do 30, 40 hours a week, and that's it. And David Heinemeier Hansson, he wrote Rails 10 hours a week. He still works 40 less hours a week. He's fairly productive. You know, lots of Django people I could point to who also, you know, not just you, but don't do crazy hours, and they're massively prolific because, as you talk about in the talk, they don't have distractions, they don't do this, they don't do that, they're focused, and that's how it is.
But the human body isn't built to do 100 hours a week every week for months and months. You can do it a week, but where's the recovery? Like, you know, even going to a conference, it takes a massive load out of you. So where's the recovery afterwards? You know, maybe there's a deadline, a drop dead date, where if this software doesn't ship on this date, then this company is going under. We've got to make a ship. Okay, maybe that deserves extra hours, but where's the recovery afterwards? And what you find in a lot of agency environments or startup environments is it's drop dead deadline, followed by immediately by another one, followed by immediately by another one, until you fall over on the floor. And that the human body just isn't built that way.
Yeah. They're not all like that, but...
Yeah, no, not all. Look, there are loads of great companies out there, but the stereotype is this. And it's more than the stereotype. It exists and it's prevalent.
Okay, well, Growing Old Gracefully, Carlton's talk.
It was really good. Well, I enjoyed it.
And I guess the last thing is I'm aware that this is what we're saying is probably in one ear out the other for maybe folks who haven't experienced this yet, but there is some truth in it. So I hope it resonates. We'll be back to our normal technical podcasts in the near future. As ever, we're at djangochat.com and chatdjango on Twitter. We'll see you all next week.
Take care. Bye-bye. Join us next time. Bye-bye.